Welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie.
Greetings and welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie, a retro podcast dedicated to the pop culture of the 80s, 90s and zeros. My name is Jason.
And I'm Rich.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Steve.
And with the release of Dial of Destiny getting closer, we thought it would be the perfect time to dust off the leather jacket, grab the fedora hat and flex our bulging muscles with our trusty whip and dive into Steven Spielberg's and George Lucas's masterpiece films of Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones is back, pursued by Belloc, befriended by Sulla, threatened by Toth, and loved by Marion. Some of them are heroes. Some of them are enemies. And all of them are returning. They are all Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's the greatest adventure film of all time.
Jones! I'm gonna blow up the Ark, Renee!
And it will always be fun.
Trust me.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Set over five films, Indiana Jones tells the adventures of archaeologist Professor Dr. Henry Walton Indiana Jones. From battling Nazis to handling supernatural powers, we got to share Indiana's funny, dangerous and romantic adventures set all over the world on his conquest to finding some of the most sought-after treasures. Not only did these films capture our imagination, but also our hearts through Harrison Ford's portrayal of Indiana and the wonderful supporting cast around him. Coming up on this episode, we've got a discussion on which is our favourite film of the franchise, what's our hopes and fears for Dial of Destiny, and we had a listener send in their thoughts and feelings on the film, which we will share too. But to start us off, guys, we thought it'd be great to just share our memories of watching Indiana Jones back in the day and what the franchise means to us, to so many other people. So we'll just go around and we'll have a little discussion from the each of us, and who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Right. Okay.
Pause. So for me, I think like a lot of these films in my formative years, these were ones I watched on TV, taped off TV, and just fell in love with. I think they just appealed to, you know, young or teenage boys, just action adventure romp. I mean, it kind of is timeless in a way. I mean, these were inspired by some of the films I'm sure Spielberg and Lucas grew up with as well, whether it was actual films or like the serials you used to get before the film showing. I just love them. I absolutely love these films. I think it's one of the first, or maybe the first film where I appreciate all the little parts, all the different components from the actual John Williams score. Actually, the way it was directed, it wasn't just like, oh, this film's entertaining. I appreciate the artistry. And Raiders, to me, is just, yeah. I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself, but Raiders is like one of the best films ever made, without a shadow of a doubt. I even remember having the actual read-along book and audio cassette of Raiders as well. So, you know, beep for turning the page, had all the music on there, clips from the film. It just... yeah, I love Indy so much. I don't want more to say, really. It's one of those things, it does exist purely within the big screen. I can't say I consumed the young Indiana Jones adventures. I didn't play any of the games. But as a trilogy of films, I just love Indy. I really do. I don't know what to say. I'm just going to gush over it. So.
Okay.
I also watched this on a ratty VHS recording off the telly many, many times. I'm also going to get ahead of myself. Spoilers for later in the podcast, but Raiders of the Lost Ark is Steven Spielberg's finest work, in my opinion. And, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect film, but, like, Raiders gets pretty fucking close. just in terms of being a really fun adventure story that has depth and complexity, but is also like really easy to understand. And as Rich was saying, just is just so very well produced and directed. You can tell what's going on at all times on the screen. Everything, all of the framing, all of the blocking, like aside from some of the, you know, dry dialogue stuff, like every frame of this film is incredibly meticulously crafted. And then there's just, you know, the genre and the themes themselves, which is just a handsome, stubbly, bearded adventurer / archaeologist / professor. It's all just so good and so great. And the thing that I love about Indiana Jones is like a franchise is that you watch the film, but you get the sense that there were other adventures before and there will be other adventures after. Mm-hmm. And the possibilities are just endless. He could go anywhere and do anything and it would be a fun time. It's fantastic.
I was an Indy fan before I was a Star Wars fan. Again, it was recorded off the TV, probably some ITV version. So I would watch them constantly. Like Steve and what Rich said as well is those you I've done the mute test with Raiders, and again, to jump ahead of ourselves, I think that film might come out on top tonight. But the mute test, you just mute the TV and watch the visuals. You don't need any dialogue to understand what Spielberg was doing. You can watch the story, follow it with no dialogue, and it is gorgeous. And like Steve has said, every scene, it's not an afterthought. All three of the first films were the same. They were astoundingly planned, astoundingly shot. The framing, the atmosphere, even the air quality that they got inside all of these different locations, even the studio shots match beautifully well. And I remember just being absolutely in love with this archaeologist adventurer. I was a big history nerd as a kid. I would pore over all these old books that my mum had, you know, accumulated over the years. Raiders is close to being a perfect movie. And again, probably Spielberg's finest hour, 2 hours. Just everything hits perfectly. And I don't know if... Was that the book you were talking about, Rich?
No. Or maybe I was wrong. Maybe I just had a cassette. Maybe it wasn't a read-along one. Maybe it was just purely an audiobook version.
I've had this since probably 1991, 92. Wow.
But for the listeners, what are you holding up, Chris?
It's the 1981 edition. It's Jesus a Corgi Christ. Book printed by Corgi, and it was priced at 95p new.
It belongs in a museum.
It does. It was actually adapted, I think, from the final script, so there's a few differences, but again, I also have the temple version as well, which has for nerds out there stills that were shot during filming which don't appear in the film.
Huh.
So it was published probably just as the film came out, so there are stills in there that aren't in temple.
Wow.
Indiana Jones as a kid, I was obsessed. And let's just hope number five is better than number four.
That was number four.
Yeah, I used it to put my coffee on this morning watching Last Crusade.
Oh dear.
That joke's never going to go.
Jason, what about you?
For me, I think it's pretty much the same as for all of us, isn't it? Like, obviously, we were too young to catch it in the cinemas properly, weren't mm-hmm. we? We never really had that. And I guess that's probably why we were quite hyped for Dial of Destiny. We get a proper opportunity to actually go and experience the Indiana Jones film in the cinema for the first time, because we were just too young to catch the originals, and Kingdom Skull never happened, so we never saw had the chance to see that either. So, you know,
we don't speak about that.
So yeah, I caught them at Christmas time was probably the best time, and mm-hmm. I guess that's probably one of the things that Indiana Jones for me has that feeling of when I watch an Indiana Jones, is that Christmassy time, New Year's Day kind of feeling. And I think that makes the films that little bit extra special for me, looking back on them, just on that on its own, not without any of the actual action and stuff that's going on in the film. But, and I always have a distinct remember of one year at Christmas time getting the trilogy on DVD, I think. and we were very hungover from New Year's Eve one day, and we just watched the trilogy of Indiana Jones on New Year's Day just to get through the hangover. So
it's a New Year's tradition. We do that.
So yeah, it's got a few fond memories for me just for the franchise on its own, and it just so helps that, you know, they're some of the best films ever made. So, you know, they've just got everything, haven't they? And they're very easy to watch. They're not very complicated plots to really follow. They're full of just great acting and great writing, but also just really interesting as well, isn't it? It's not like something that you would necessarily look into as a kid, maybe, I don't know, or even as an adult, I guess. It's not something that you would usually think to look into or know a lot about. So to see this, like, professor, teacher, have this like secret identity in some ways, where he's like some kind of like super archaeologist who goes around whipping people and beating up bad guys and everything and grabbing hold of treasures, and it just captures your imagination.
I think it does come down to I kind of look at the Indiana Jones trilogy as it does have this kind of like Saturday morning, like cartoon adventure kind of feel, even though they are actual live action films. I think watching it as a kid growing up, that was the first kind of time I had this like real larger than life, big, bold hero that I could almost pretend you could, you know, roll around the house, pretend to be like, yeah, you know, 'cause it wasn't, if you were going to dress up as him, it would be easy to do. It's easy to replicate the things he did. It wasn't like it was outer space stuff. It was just like, I'm gonna do a Ford roll on the couch because I'm like escaping this like booby trap or, you know, massive boulder. And it's just silly stuff like that. You could kind of imagine yourself in his shoes and you'd watch it and it just would capture your imagination.
And that's what filmmaking's all about, is like when I was old enough and the internet was invented, kids, I actually went back to look at the adventure serials that inspired the films.
Yeah.
What's amazing to me is how accurately they modernized it, decided to set it during the war, or, you know, Second World War, but the themes and the visuals are literally lifted and reshot in Spielberg style from these serials. And they're fascinating to watch because some of them are silent serials, some of them are just old school adventure movies, and to be able to translate that and essentially remake it or reimagine it in the 80s was mind-blowing. And I'd never seen what inspired them until the DVD features came along and they showed you clips and stuff, what inspired. And again, to say what I said earlier, where you can mute the TV and appreciate what the visuals are doing for storytelling, that's what they managed to capture. It's almost as if they went, let's make a silent movie first and add the script later. It's that kind of structure and it works so well. I didn't look into them properly, but just to get a sense of it. And then once you do watch those and then you watch the first three films, you can see where they were going with it and the idea behind it, the genesis of it, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, they wore those inspirations on their sleeves, right? And they've talked about it many times since. They were just like, we want to make pulpy serials, but, you know, for the big screen, and we're going to produce it to the nth degree and get it perfect. And you can see it all over Raiders in particular, where everything is going to happen in 2 seconds time, but it takes 2 minutes on the screen. Like, when Indy's running out of the first temple, that door is going to fucking close on him and he's very far away from it, but he still gets through. You know, it barely exists in reality, but it's done so well that you just really get to just, you know, soak in the pulpy vibe. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there, really, with that kind of feelings that it brought over to you from those kind of action points. And also, like, from the supernatural points as well of the films was, I think, what threw a load of people, including myself, when I first watched it, because it's not a film. It's always set out to be films that you wouldn't expect to have those kind of parts of the plot or in the film, would you? And all of a sudden, they're throwing ghosts at you and, you know, and all these kind of supernatural stuff. And I think that was just another added layer of the films that just really brought out the uniqueness of Indiana Jones.
Yeah. I'm jealous of people that got to see this film for the first time in the cinema that didn't know what would happen when you opened the Ark. Because up to that point, completely straight, no paranormal stuff. Indiana's like, if you believe in that kind of thing, you know, I just want the Ark because it's an antique. I don't believe that there's anything to it. And then at the end, Nazis' faces melt. And I bet watching that for the first time, I bet that was bonkers.
I still love the Raiders that, like, when you boil it down, Indy actually had no bearing on the outcome of the film. Like, literally, events just take place.
Yeah.
He's tied to a post just watching it. Like, he doesn't steer the movie towards its final outcome.
He runs interference, right? But the Nazis got exactly what they wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But they wouldn't have found the Ark if they didn't notice that someone was digging a few hundred meters away from the actual dig.
Oh, true.
So that's a technicality.
They would have brute forced their way to that, though, right? Yeah. Like, they'd have found it eventually. Yeah.
But what I love about the ending to Raiders is Indy and Marion don't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
Out of sheer fear and respect, he says, shut your eyes, don't look at it, because that guy knows his stuff. And knows his legends and knows the history, and he still never sees anything. They just open her eyes and all the Nazis are gone and been vacuum sucked back into the Ark and destroyed. But what I love about the films and the ending especially is Indy is a human being. He makes mistakes. He's not perfect. He gets hit. He gets beaten up. And it normalizes it. He's not, like Rich said earlier, he's not some space pirate who's invincible and he's got plot armor. He just has these normal failings that every human being does. But when you look into the history of the Ark of the Covenant in itself, so many different theories come out. Like, one theory is the Ark wasn't an actual thing. It's an idea. It's knowledge passed down through generations. But if it was a physical thing, it needs to be for a film. It needs to be this lovely ornate gold thing. And it's just that glorious ending where even Indy doesn't see anything. He refuses to open his eyes. And it's just one of those moments where I didn't even figure it out till about 10 years ago. I was like, wait a minute, he has no idea.
No.
And the flip side of that is, what's the, is it Tote his name or Tot? The bald guy with glasses?
Oh, yeah.
The way he laughs when Belloc puts his hand in and it's dust is almost as if he's laughing because he either saw it coming, that it's just... It's subjective, isn't it? So maybe the Ark manifests whatever someone wants, and if the Nazis are Nazis, the Ark's not going to give them shit, is it?
That's kind of cool, actually. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
So, again, it goes back to the whole, if you believe it, you will see it. That kind of notion. So if the Nazis are evil, the ghosties are going to come out and destroy them.
I like the idea of God being an anti-fascist. I'm down. Yeah. I'm down with that.
Yeah, because if there was a God, he would be.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I really like it. I think it's a good point, though. I really like the idea that, I mean, obviously all the Nazis are gone, so he knows some shit went down. But it's a good shout that, because I really like the idea that they didn't see anything, because obviously that would really mess you up and change your life forever, right? And there are two more films after this where he doesn't talk about that all the time, which is what you would do if you'd seen that. But it's because he didn't see it. And that's a really cool little detail.
There's many film franchises that have occurred over the years that have just, like, where lightning's just struck gold. Everything's just come together from the actors that were cast to the film, to the screenwriters, to the directors and everything. I think Indiana Jones and the first three films specifically are testament to that. Saying definitely, but I mean, I guess one of the biggest things that helped with making these films so big and popular, I guess, were the actors that were cast as the films. And I mean, I meant to look it up beforehand. I'm sure Chris probably knows some of the actors maybe that were in line for the role of Indiana Jones before Harrison Ford, but I think ultimately Harrison Ford does make Indiana Jones, you know, so much. I think any other kind of actor, I don't know if it would have had the same impact.
Hmm. No, like,
well, Harrison Ford's the everyman, isn't he? He's literally, he's the carpenter guy who became famous.
Mm-hmm.
I was forgetting the carpenter. Oh god, yeah.
Yeah, he's got that humble origins thing about him. He's just got that lovely, just nice dude that you'd hang around and hang out with and drink a few beers in the pub. I think, was it Tom Selleck's name was thrown around, and I couldn't imagine anyone else than Harrison. But then I suppose if we got that film with another actor, we wouldn't know any different.
We wouldn't know any different. No, but it wouldn't be. But you know, Harrison Ford, like, he's so perfect for this because, you know, he runs interference and makes a lot of mistakes and he fucks up a lot, right? And Harrison Ford works so well because nobody takes a punch like Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Nobody trips over or falls over or gets injured or fucks up or looks shocked and confused when things don't go his way like Harrison Ford. So it is hard to imagine anyone else being able to do it justice.
Yeah, definitely. It's you know, his rugged good looks probably goes a long way
I mean, it would be off topic, but not really. But someone actually, I believe, did a deep fake of Tom Selleck as Indiana Jones a few years back, complete with Tash.
Of course.
And it's quite interesting to see. Just thought I'd throw that out there for everyone. Just look it up and just see what it would be like.
Check that out now. Yeah, I don't know about that.
Got to be seen, I think. It sounds really interesting or scary. Because I think every time I watch Tom Selleck, I just watch his Tash. It's like an Magnum thing.
You just imagine Magnum PI.
Yeah, exactly.
Ted Danson as a short round.
Yeah.
It's one hell of a deep fake.
What about some of like the other like actors, characters of Indiana Jones? Did you guys have another like, you know, specific kind of favourite, like supporting
Karen Allen, without a shadow of a doubt. Sorry, I love Marianne. Always will love Marianne.
Yes.
Yeah. She's amazing.
She's America's little sweetheart, Karen Allen. And she's so effortless and she's so natural. And that's, and again, very progressive for 1980. Was it 1981?
1981.
To have such a strong take no shit attitude,
drinking dudes representation. Under the table and,
so yeah, it's and like, then, yes, but and it's in the same vein. Of its time. The final two thirds of this film, they strip that away, and she becomes it's
a two-dimensional screaming. Yes. Yeah.
But you're not wrong. Her introduction to this film is incredible, and she's fantastic in it.
Speaking of introductions, I just want to bring up Steven Spielberg's penchant for silhouette usage. It is glorious in every one of the films, apart from Crystal Skull, which was filmed on a Sony Handycam on a soundstage. They even closed a ride at Disneyland to film some of the two. Oh god, they're like two completely different directors. You watch Number Four, and then you watch the first three. They're not made by the same man.
Nah.
Clearly not. I don't know. I don't know.
We'll get there. I'm sure.
But just the silhouettes, the digging at the sunset on the
fucking
his entrance. The bar,
like the opening
gorgeous
shot after you've dissolved away from the Paramount logo.
Oh god.
And he
steps
up. And like, I watched it today. I watched Raiders today, and then we watched The Last Crusade straight after that. But when he just steps up and you've got that silhouette of the hat and the jacket and stuff, you don't really like, you didn't realize at the time just how like seminal that is, and how, because you look at that now and you're like, it's Indiana Jones. That's who that guy is. But like, that's the introduction. That's the first time you see him, and like, I love the way you don't see his face for a while.
It's the classic tease, isn't it?
Yeah, he just teased. Oh man! And then all the shadow work in Marion's bar is amazing as
And just when Harrison steps out of the shadows and into full frame, and you're just like, wow. Like, but the commanding presence that Harrison has, he's just got that beautiful, like, almost alpha male quality that he doesn't have to say anything. He just walks in front of the camera. That's Harrison Ford. And it's just beautifully done. And
just such a great facial actor as well. Like, that opening of Raiders when he's, you know, when he's looking at the artifact, and he's kind of, you see, he's eyeing it up, he's weighing it up in his mind, he's thinking about how much it weighs, he's stroking the chin, he's kind of like, you know, it's just, it's so expressive. And there's no dialogue. You know, Alfred Molina's like 50 feet behind him, doing nothing, just watching. And
rubbing his fingers together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just Harrison Ford on his own, acting. He's conveying so much just through like the stroke of a face and, you know,
but
those eyes. Like, it's just...
That's what I mean. There are not many actors that could pull that off. And I think Rich would kind of agree with me here. Matt Smith, who is the Doctor, is a very subtle facial actor where you feel everything that's going on. Like, when that shot of the boulder coming down that seals the tomb, that he's got to outrun so the boulder doesn't seal him in. When he looks and turns around, Harrison Ford did a shot that you see in many cartoons where the camera turns around and then you've got that dolly zoom, almost dolly zoom Kubrick style that, you know, Spielberg used for Jaws as well. And he's got that moment of like sheer like, what the? Almost, and he's got to run. Harrison Ford does that look of awe and amazement at the same time as being terrified and doing all the calculations in his head how he's going to get out in a second. And he does the same when he thinks he gets shot in Marion's bar. And I'm on the team that says that is the single best second in the film, when the gun goes off and in a tenth of a second he looks down and pats himself so quickly as if say, am I shot?
Yeah.
It's just beautifully done, and it's all no dialogue. And I just we could talk about these films.
Good. There are two other films I have to remind us all.
we'll touch on those in a minute. Yeah, like I think the other, like one of the other supporting famous actors of the Indiana Jones franchise comes from Temple of Doom, obviously, and that's Short Round, and just one of my like little favourite like characters of the film, because he's just so cheeky and confident kind of little guy, isn't he?
Yeah. And can you imagine being that age and being friends with Indiana Jones?
Yeah, seriously.
Like, that's how I felt when I watched that film. It's like, fuck, I wish that I was Short Round. That must be what a life. What a life that must be. That must be amazing.
Gonna go and try and, you know, pickpocket Harrison Ford and see if he, you know, befriends you.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, I think I read somewhere that the origins of Short Round was he had no parents and was a homeless kid on the streets of Shanghai.
Yeah,
but it never made it into the film. For some reason, I just remember I read it, or it must have been a DVD feature or commentary. I heard it somewhere, but it's quite a very interesting plot point that you never think of. You just assume that this kid's great friends with this adventuring archaeologist. You don't question it until you're an adult, and then you start questioning, like,
wait, what?
How do we get there? Okay.
And also, you don't question where he goes either, because, like, the timeline of Temple of Doom, right, it's set before Raiders, right? If I remember rightly? Yeah. So it's
technically a prequel.
Where the fuck did Short Round go? Who knows? That's, you know.
Dead.
But that's kind of that film all over. Temple of Doom's kind of an anomaly in a few ways, right?
Yeah.
It is, but it's equally beautifully shot.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely stunning.
But before we get into each of the films, I guess there's just one other thing that I think is quite an important factor as well of the success of Indiana Jones. And it was the first time that two powerhouses of directing had come together as well. Like the excitement that must have been around the time that they announced that Spielberg was working with Lucas to create like Raiders and go on to the other two films must have been incredible. And like, these two people just coming together, it's just really like, I don't know how to explain it really.
I don't know what the reaction would have been really. It's hard to say, because I kind of look at it now as this is all like pre-internet days where you don't build. Yes, you've got directors or actors or whatever that are held in high regard, but for like obviously then we didn't have the internet to build up this aura around them, and you know, you didn't have like an actual rabid, like, you know, nerd or geek or pop culture audience. It was just, these were films, and I don't know, maybe there was a real excitement about it. I don't know. I feel like
I'm sure to some people there were, yeah, yeah. I'm sure
I feel
to
like
some people
it was now, like a, then yeah, it'd be way more rabid, yeah. You know, the guy that directed Ready Player One, the guy that directed Attack of the Clones, work together.
Yeah.
Yes, let's do this.
Yeah, because everyone would flock to the cinema to see that collab, wouldn't they?
They would. They would.
But it made me think, because like I watched a few trailers on YouTube today, trying to pick one for the show, and there was one original like teaser trailer that I watched, and it just came up in black background with white light writing, and it just said like from the creator of Jaws, and then the creator of Star Wars, and like come together to make Indiana Jones. And that just made me think, like, wonder what that kind of, how that made people feel back then when they saw that trailer, maybe even.
But again, it doesn't occur to you how early in Spielberg's career this was.
Yeah,
I suppose, yeah.
Because Indiana Jones to us has always been there. You know, by the time I was 4.5, 5, the 3 films already been out. Mm-hmm. So it's been around for literally our whole lives. Mm. We see it in, you could say the future tense, can't you, where you see Spielberg's catalogue of blockbusters. E.T., Close Encounters, Jaws, you see all of his 80s stuff, and his executive produced stuff, Back to the Future, The Goonies, that kind of thing. But it'd be interesting to look up, because there were like film clubs, weren't there, that would give out like fanzines, wouldn't they? Like movie news that they'd got from scouts in studios and stuff. So I suppose the information was out there on the press, but not to the extent it is now, where you're bombarded with every information. Every bit of information is almost overwhelming some days. Like, but I've never had the opportunity to see one of these in the cinema either, apart from the one that should not be named.
Oh dear.
So let's get into the film specifically then, and we'll try not to dwell on each one too long, because you know there's a lot to get through, I guess. But and like our favourite films of the franchise, and I think you three have all kind of answered that question with it being Raiders of the Lost Ark. For me, I've chosen a different film, so that's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Not Raiders. Do I get a bogey point, or you know, do I get?
It's Last Crusade, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Bloody hope so.
Yeah,
I have thoughts on the second one. So
okay,
yeah, I mean that now you understand why I put that meme up. One does not simply choose just three, because if I could, it would be a 6-hour long movie with a few bits taken out here and there.
Yeah,
but so well, I mean, we've already said a few things about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, the best of the bunch.
To me, it's perfection. It's the way every second of it doesn't feel wasted. Every scene is like accompanied by music that's just so memorable. Every frame of that film matters.
Yes,
and I can almost just have it playing in my mind. It's imprinted, and it just
you don't shut your eyes and hit play.
Don't get many films like that, and if they do, chances are they probably are from Spielberg. I think of Jurassic Park. I think of Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then probably more recently, something like Mad Max Fury Road. They're just stamped in my head and I can't shift them. And I love it. Like Temple of Doom, like, on the other hand.
Raiders is like if everybody had a certain shape in their brain, and that is the movie shape, Spielberg made a film that replicated that shape perfectly, and it slots perfectly in, and it just feels so good to watch.
Yeah.
I don't know if what I said makes any sense.
It does, 100%.
Mm-hmm. That's what it feels like to Weisheffer. It's like he set out to make and then made exactly what he set out to make, you know, and it's just perfect. Yep. Not a perfect film, but a perfect film, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I agree, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, so good, so good. I mean, specific moments. I love when Alfred Molina gets spiked because he betrays Indy at the beginning. What else happens? Name some good moments. The guy who gets killed by the propeller.
Mm-hmm.
Like this film is like, it's like a family adventure film, right? But it's got a fucking edge to it. There's a really gnarly headshot quite near the beginning.
And even just this whole bit in the market as well, which kind of takes the piss out of movie conventions, like with the guy with the sword.
It does.
He's doing a... And like, you're just like, oh, whatever, I'm bored of this shit. And I always remember my dad just loved that, because he always gets frustrated with films that do that, where it's just lots of unnecessary preamble in a fight or unnecessary talking. It's like, you wouldn't do this in real life. You just get on with the
fight. Well, the legendary story behind that, right, is that they were supposed to be an elaborate fight scene, but everyone got food poisoning, and Harrison Ford just said, why don't I just shoot him? And Steven Spielberg went, that's a good idea, let's do that. And it's like way better for it.
The whole cast and crew all ate a couple of big restaurants in Tunisia, and they were all ill.
It's the fucking dates, man. It's the dates.
Yeah, it's the bad dates. Yeah. Apart from, surprise, surprise, George Lucas, who had tinned food and bottled water shipped from the States to Tunisia.
Oh, yeah.
Of course
he's the only one not ill.
He's definitely that guy, isn't he? Yeah.
What I love is the fights are choreographed to a point where they're almost perfect. They're not slow. They're not slow fighting, you know, like fucking Star Trek style Kirk fighting, you know, really slow. They are brawls.
Yeah. Mm.
But they are choreographed so meticulously that they flow so naturally that we've all either been in those fights or seen those fights happen. And it looks so genuine because it just does. I don't know how they choreographed it to be that way because it's not forced. No one's stiff. Now, proper full-on fist fights, people falling over, tripping over. And it's just...
And that, like, it's not like a Star Wars, like a later Star Wars film where you're watching the fight to watch the fight. The fight is progressing the story. Like, it's not a fight for a fight's sake. It's not just to have a fight scene. As it progresses, the story is progressing. The when he fights the big burly guy, and you can tell there's a back and forth where he gains ground and loses ground and gains ground. There's a point where the burly guy just smacks him in the face, and he gets his bell rung and is a bit uneasy on his feet before flopping down.
Yep.
And it's just a perfect little moment. Like Harrison Ford sold that perfectly.
And my favorite moment of that scene that you've just said is on one of my favorite. This is gonna get really deep, guys. On the DVD menus, that punch is synchronized perfectly to a crescendo on the DVD menu. I know it's a very deep cut. I know, but I remember it stuck in my head that
I miss DVD menus. But the work that went into them, seriously, it's disgusting.
Oh, so good.
They've gone.
And it's just Harrison Ford's just that defeated, craggy guy that just takes a few seconds to come back to get his second, third, fourth and fifth wind.
Amazing.
And up he gets.
But like in every fight scene, you know where he is at all times. You know where the burly guy is. You know where the plane is. You know there's oil approaching it. You know there's a fire over there. Like it's so clear in your head and it's not confusing at all. And it's just such a pleasure to watch.
That's why it works so well when you just mute the TV and just watch it. It's just... And they don't linger on these shots. It's like visual exposition, but it's not... It's like one or two frames. Go. And in 5 seconds, you've got five plot points or five items that are happening. It is programming your brain to expect what's going to happen, like you said, in 2 or 3 minutes' time.
Yeah. Like tons of inserts as well. Like the guy's arm lands on the lever and the levers go forward and that's like a second and a half, but now you know why the plane's spinning around and you know why they're in danger, you know why the propellers are going faster. Yeah, incredible stuff.
Let's get this out of the way then, guys, and let's discuss Temple of Doom. Like we've had hints that maybe, you know, you've got some opinions on this film that maybe not as popular as what you had for Raiders, and interested to get into those.
Yeah, I'm going to say, I don't like Temple of Doom. I don't think it's a good film, truthfully. And I know people hold it dear. I look at it kind of as just that kind of slapdash, thrown together sequel. I look at it similar to like Conan the Destroyer, where, he's got friends now and they're kind of a bit annoying. I'm sorry, Short Round's charming, but still, it just feels too much. You juxtapose it with like the opening of Raiders, which was masterful. And I just found the opening kind of a mess.
I love the opening. Are you kidding me?
I like the whole. I like the musical number, Kate Capshaw. It's actually quite good. A bit problematic because it's all these white women.
It's
like, and the mystery stage that happens to double in size in between shots. But that's a thing for another time.
If you're gonna enjoy Temple, problematic is the word, and you have to make your peace with it, and you have to put that to one side because there's a lot of weird shit like that in this film. I like it just fine. I like it. It's a good film. I enjoy it. It's an Indiana Jones film. It's one of those adventures that you know is happening at other times, except we get to see this one. But it's problematic, and it is a bit much at times.
Yeah. I remember seeing an interview somewhere where they justified the choices of Temple of Doom's subject matters by saying that it was done deliberately to poke fun at people's expectations and ideals at the time in the early 30s of foreign cultures such as India and the bloated British Empire, who just like invaded and said, you know, to quote Eddie Izzard, "Do you have a flag? We now own your country." They justified their choices, I think, to go, yeah, we misstepped a little bit here with these representations. So we're just gonna pad it. We're going to buffer it. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, if you knew that those problems were going to be a problem when you made the film, then why did you put those in there in the first place? If you knew you were treading on eggshells and walking a fine line, why was it done that way? Like the fuggy culture, yeah, that's a real thing. It's a, you know, but when you get down to the food scene,
chilled monkey brains,
so bad,
yeah, eating bugs and stuff, and like they didn't do that in that part of India. They never have, but for some reason in the Indiana Jones universe they're a bit weird. They're out of
eyeballs in this soup. These people are fucked up.
I found it problematic, but I found it equal parts I just found it annoying. It just annoyed me. Like, and it wasn't because it was problematic. I just felt like it was just a bit infantile. And I was like, what is this shit? Like, I don't like Temple of Doom.
Temple of Doom has been called the Looney Tunes version of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And for quite justified reasons, but like, I love the opening. I think it's great. From a visual filmmaking point of view, you've got Harrison Ford in that proper Sean Connery-esque suit walking down those stairs like Humphrey Bogart meets Sean Connery, and it just looks stunning. But sometimes it's too funny. Indiana Jones has always had that underlying humour, but they did humour, but subtly. They did gags, but very subtle. They really thought about it or just brushed it under the rug, but when you watch parts of Temple, it's very obviously done, you know, do you get it? Do you get the joke? And it's constant. And I think the addition of Short Round, I think, was deliberate to get more bums on seats and young people interested. Because if you get a young person in a film, because there are no young characters in Raiders.
No.
There are no young characters in Last Crusade, only in Temple. And I think it's that sequel syndrome, isn't it? What did we not do in the first one that we can do in the second one? More humour. Let's get a child representation in the film. Yeah, there are a few bits. It's enjoyable, yes, but I can see, as I've gotten older, the problems that it has. Visually, musically, stunning. But again, the polar opposite of Kate Capshaw between Karen Allen. I knew you said Lily Allen, and that would have been...
I watched it.
I don't understand the point of Willie Scott there, other than the fact that she was banging Steven Spielberg.
That's literally it. So,
wait, hang on. Was that before this production? I thought they met on set.
That's what Spielberg says, but we all know.
Okay,
that,
I see.
Because she was, I can't remember if she was a production associate or an extra or some film background. That's how she managed to get onto one of his projects. So. But Steven was married at the time. But I just find you go from the really confident Marion in the first film to, again, the damsel in distress trope.
Yeah. Completely disempowered the whole time. Yeah. Really annoying.
Falls apart over the most simple... And you're just like, I get it. But it's too ham-fisted to say, oh, Indy's got to look after these two people, this young nipper and this woman. He's got to really look after these guys. So I just don't understand, and I've never understood it. And as I've gotten older, I still don't understand. She doesn't bring anything to the film. No. She's very wooden in a way. I'm not an actor. I'm not judging people, but it's just like, if Spielberg fought with his brains and not his testicles, we would have had a better love interest in the film. It just, and then you go into number three and you've got Alison Doody, which is a brilliant name.
That was Ella,
and
wasn't
she's
it?
Elsa. Yeah,
Elsa. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. And
well, I'd forgotten she, about. Yeah. Completely, and I watched Last Crusade, and I was like, "Hello!" I was like, "Yeah, I remember this."
Yeah.
I was like,
and then she would do that amazing turn as this, you know, Nazi, and then she would be in A View to a Kill, and it's like, "Oh God.
God, yeah, yeah, it is her, isn't it?"
She was damn. Jenny Flex.
Sorry. Jenny Flex.
Oh, James Bond has its problems, but I just Temple of Doom. You could edit half that film out and end up with a nice short film that could set nicely in between the films.
It's a shame too, because that minecart chase, pretty fucking rad.
Oh, it's glorious.
The jungle bridge, the that jungle rope bridge, brilliant. Incredible. And the jungle rope bridge is like a key Indiana Jones scene.
Yep.
And it's in the worst film, sadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the minecart is like masterful.
It's incredible. Yeah.
And I kept watching it the whole time thinking, if we had this in a film today, that would all be CGI. And it always was miniatures, trick photography, little physical portions of a set. And I was just like, this is so beautiful.
That's the problem that we get when you get to number four. When, right?
I know. The problem with number four.
the many problems of number four. Indiana Jones exists in reality, not, I mean more figuratively. Mm. Every effect shot, miniature, set extension is either a matte painting, a miniature, a bigature, or full-size goddamn set, right? You get to the fourth one, and we're just going to CG everything. It takes that physicality away from it. And the minecart chase in Temple is a prime example. Like Rich just said, it would be full CG. We get any of the realism. The whole point of miniatures and animation, in a way, you get the real reactive light. You get the elements reacting with it. You shoot it. You put mist in the air. You... like a fog machine or just dust, and then you put some really creative lights in it, boom. And that minecart chase is meticulously done and it is absolutely glorious. It's done so quickly that you can almost not tell when it's a miniature or stuntman in the carts, because it's filmed, they match the frame rate for the miniature to the full-size set.
Yeah.
So then when you blend it together, it matches. But the frame rate had to be done slower for the miniature, faster for the miniature shot, and it's nuts. But
and some of the shots got those as well, like the minecart's going real fast, and the bad guys are in it holding their rifles, and that's a miniature shot. It looks like those are the actors bobbing around in the minecart, but that's a miniature shot. It's mad.
Yeah, they used, I believe, G.I. Joe figures. Well, it would be Action Man over here, I believe. Mm-hmm. They use Action Man figures, and then they put an armature in, so every time they could reset it for the motion control. So there were little notches on the track, so every time the cart went over a certain point, the figure would move in exactly the same way on every part of the track it hit, so they could reset the motion control rig. But it's just, it's a standout of that whole film, is that minecart chase.
That's what we mean when we talk about how meticulous these films are. Like the jungle, the rope bridge part, the bodies that fall off are... they have mechanics in them. They're like robots, so that their arms and legs would flail around.
Crazy.
And they're weighted correctly so that they would look realistic. As if, like, it's a crazy amount of craft that goes into these things.
Yeah, and a bit of a, not a tangent, but when the water containers tipped over to literally flush them out of the mine, there's this interesting story that when they looked at all the old serials, and even films made in the 70s and in the early 80s, where the water effects, water doesn't scale down.
Mm-hmm.
It can scale up, but you can't scale it down. So the smaller your miniature, the more fake it looks. So when the water's coming through the miniature mine tunnels, they got contacted by, ILM got contacted by someone that said, how did you do your water shot? How did you not make those water droplets look massive? And they had air compressors that atomized the water as it came down. So as it atomized the water droplets, they scaled down beautifully. So in the miniature, it looks right. And all it was just compressed air.
Wow.
Crazy.
That's mad.
And I found that was on the Blu-ray features as well. I was like, wow, like that's just, you don't think about it. But they think about it, so you don't have to think about it. So when you sit there and it sells the shot, because they thought about it, and then you don't have to think about it.
And that's magic.
Well, let's move on to The Last Crusade, which was my pick of like the favorite out of the three original films. Like, I think the main reason I like The Crusade that much was getting some kind of backstory to Indiana, I suppose, and getting that whole scene at the beginning of the film with the young Indiana Jones as a scout and, you know, nabbing that artifact from the fake Indiana.
I love that little fake out at the start. That was really, really great. Yeah. It's so well done.
And obviously just with the addition of Sean Connery as his dad, like the chemistry between the two just bounced off each other and through the screen to the audience that just made it a pleasure to watch, especially with those two on screen at the same time. Just, you know, dad calling him Junior and everything else. Just, I think just those two elements on its own just made the film more for me than the other two.
It was very tough for me to choose between Raiders and Crusade for that exact reason. The opening to Last Crusade is a masterpiece of almost a small vignette. It's almost like a short movie. And to have Sean Connery playing Harrison Ford's father in an Indiana Jones movie was inspired. And it just lands beautifully. Raiders just beat it for me for my choice. There's, again, the problem I have with Raiders is it forgets who Marcus Brody is.
Oh, you mean Marcus Brody is now a complete moron in The Last Crusade?
Yeah. I
noticed that when I watched it today. It's like, wait, what did they do to this character?
And you look in Raiders, and he's this confident guy that you could almost imagine was the previous generation's Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. You could almost imagine that Marcus Brody took a young indie straight out of college and taught him these ways, and he was the retired version, if you will, this adventurer. Then you have the temple movie in the middle, and then you have him come into Last Crusade, and you're like, great, Denholm Elliott's back. And then you're like, what is this? This bumbling guy who is so arrogantly British. It takes me out of the film every time I see it, because that's not the character that was established in Raiders.
It almost feels like one of those situations where they just like recast him and he plays a different character.
Yeah.
You don't think it's Denholm Elliott. Yeah. You think, who the fuck is this guy? He's like Steve Gunberg or something.
Yeah, so, and like...
So weird.
This is...
I think that's kind of the vibe of The Last Crusade, though. Like, I love The Last Crusade. It's better than Temple. I love it. But bear with me here. I've softened on... I haven't watched Crystal Skull in a long time. But I remember what I didn't like about Crystal Skull was that it was too much CGI, but it was also stupid. I remember thinking that film was stupid. But then I watched Crusade today. Crusade's fucking stupid. when he's one of the best reveals in film history is where young Indy has the hat put on his head, and when he looks up, we cut to
the transition.
It's fantastic.
Beautiful.
But that scene on the ship, Indiana Jones does a double punch. He swings once and punches two guys in the face at the same time. There's a scene later where three Nazis stand in a row shoots once and shoots all three of them. This film is really dumb. And I don't think I realized how dumb it was. I love it. But now I'm thinking maybe Crystal Skull's not that bad. Because that's pretty dumb too, right?
Well,
I don't know. Because I felt like Crystal Skull sort of ruined the sanctity of Indiana Jones.
You think about,
but I didn't realize that Crusades like doesn't have a lot of reverence for itself either. He speaks to a 700-year-old knight in a cave.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like the gun gag though, because they're so used to using revolvers, like American-made revolvers, and then they go to Germany. Or German soldiers and German efficiency, and this gun wipes out like three or four people in one. That gag works for me because it's almost as if it's setting up, Indy's found a new perfect gun. You can almost see him going, I don't need this. He throws the revolver away and pockets the German gun.
But it happens because they stand in a line.
Yeah.
Probably Deadpool style.
That's what I mean. Yeah. It's like the Pirates of the Caribbean kebab joke, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, Crusade, it's full of gags, isn't it? Mm. And maybe that's to his detriment. Like, probably just a few too many gags, isn't there?
I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, they definitely played quite broad with Sean Connery, I think. But I found it endearing. Like, I think of how cool and stoic he was as Bond, and I see this old man that's, he's kind of doddery, but he's also very sharp. Mm-hmm. And he's very comedic, and he was a generally good comedic presence. The bit with the lighter when he drops it on the carpet, he's always like he doesn't want Indy to know, but it's like he's gonna find out because his fucking shit's burning. The bit on the beach with the seagulls when he scares them off the umbrella.
And he shoots the tail of their own plane, and doesn't what's the matter? Want them to know as well.
Yeah. Oh, are we hit? Yeah. Yes.
I'm afraid
yes.
so.
They got us, Junior. I think he's great.
I love Sean Connery in this film because it allowed him to just relax for probably the first time in his, at that point, nearly 40-year career in film.
He was having fun,
film.
You could really see it.
The only bit that I've never liked in this, and it feels so forced, and it's too slapstick, is when he says, "Sometimes I find that if I just sit,"
mm-hmm. yeah,
and then ever since I was young, I've hated that scene. I don't know why. It's just too. It's too Looney Tunes, DuckTales type.
They decided how they made progress to get out of that room on a Friday afternoon, and they were like, "Done. That'll do." He sits on a chair. It opens the stairway. Done.
Yeah. But like, if he hadn't have said, "Sometimes I find if I just sit, mm-hmm. the answer comes to me," I'm like, I can forgive the revolving fireplace gag. I love that gag because they don't know that it's a German Nazi base until this fireplace revolves. There's a whole monitoring station behind, and then they just go back around.
And I still love the visual of that whole scene as well. Just the fact that everything's on fire but the fireplace. It's the one place where they're safe. I just think, beautiful. It's so simple, but I was like, I know you did that. It's very cute, and I like it so much.
In that scene too, it's one of the few times in this film where Indiana does horrific things to other humans because he blocks the door so that they can't come back through and just lets them be succumbed by the flames in that room, which is horrific. Like, you don't see it, but it's horrific. And then he's just like, "Come on, Dad, let's go."
Yeah.
But they even like put it in the script, don't you? There's like, "Junior, look what you did." Because his dad, whether you admit it or not, is just a bookworm pacifist of a guy, isn't he? Yeah. Like, and then he sees his son that he hasn't seen in many years just mow down a dozen Nazis in 5 minutes. And he's just like, it's the bit on the bike when he's just like, "Dad, did you see what I just did with that pole?" And he's just sat there grumpy and just stares him down. Yeah. And he just... The indie smile is just wiped off his face. He's just like, "Yeah, whatever."
The contrast between between Indiana and his dad is brilliantly done at the very end of the film, because Henry Sr., he's an archaeologist for the knowledge. Henry Jr. is an archaeologist because he wants to have the thing.
Mm.
And when he's hanging down the gap and he can almost reach out to grab the grail, and his dad just goes, "Let it go, Junior." And it's a really good moment.
That was nice.
And it just illustrates the contrast between those two really well. Because he's satisfied. He's like, "I've seen it. I've been here. That's fine. I don't need to have it."
And that's the point of the film, is two estranged people finding each other again and understanding each other for the first time in their lives. And when you know that message, the payoff for the end of the film becomes amazingly done.
Yeah.
And you just see for the first time Sean Connery's eyes smile at his son. The way it's played throughout the entire film, all of a sudden Henry Sr. gets Henry Jr.
Yeah.
And then there's this mutual respect. It's just that glorious thing. And for anyone interested out there, no, because Indy drank from the cup, he's not immortal. He's only immortal if he stays in the temple as a guard of the Grail for about 1,000 years.
What happened to the knight at the end? Because
just goes back, makes a cup of tea.
A bunch of dudes turned up and just fucked up his cave. What's he doing now?
Yeah, it's implied that he kind of dies with the whole temple, because now the Grail has been buried. No one's ever going to find it for another few thousand years.
I guess so.
But you never see it, so...
Yeah. Time team.
I've never really...
Tony Robinson found it.
Yeah. Never really thought about that, actually.
Because he just waves at them. Yeah. I always feel really sorry for him. He waves at them as they leave, and it's just like, what's he doing now? Like, his job's gone. I've been doing that job for 700 years, mate. The fuck do I do now?
Yeah. Got nothing to guard now, because it's a few thousand feet in the ground now.
I chose poorly.
That shot by ILM is gorgeous. When Julian Glover just disintegrates.
I forget it's Julian Glover.
There's so many James Bond connections in that film. It's off the fucking scale.
I want to backtrack very, very briefly to Temple of Doom as well. Also, the Dan Aykroyd cameo I totally forgot about. Yeah. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Yep.
Wait, I don't remember this.
He's
the guy who charts the plane for him.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, I know that voice.
And do you know what? I was completely unaware probably until about 10 years ago that was Dan Aykroyd. I was blown away when someone pointed it out to me. I was just like, and as soon as that's pointed out to you, you can hear it and you can see it. You can hear it and see it. And I was like, how have I not noticed this? I've been watching this film for like 15, 20 years. I had no idea.
And Alexis Sale as well in Last Crusade.
Yes, he's
great. Yeah. Like, that's definitely Alexis Sale. I was like, oh, yep, credits confirmed. I was like, interesting.
That's an interesting scene, that, because that sort of plays against the racism of Temple, right? Because they try to pay him off with like fancy jewels. And he's like, I want the car, mate.
Yeah. I want the Rolls Royce.
I want the Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
Well, what do you guys think of the Adolf Hitler gag in Crusade?
Did he, I was talking, did he sign autographs? Was he like a, was he like the Beatles during?
I if you look at if you really think about it, Hitler probably wasn't signing autographs.
No,
but in context of the film, when this soldier turns up and he's got a book open. What's the first thing that if you're a self-loving, maniacal, mass-murdering fuckhead and you think you're the most important thing since the fucking sun,
and you want, want everybody to love you because
you'd sign your fucking name in a book.
I was talking earlier about how dumb this film was, and I forgot, A, the Spitfire flies into a tunnel. And
why did he do that?
Like, I don't know. And B, fucking Adolf Hitler cameo. And he interacts with the main character. The Last Crusade is dumb as shit. Like, I love it, but it's bonkers.
That's right. If it was Crystal Skull, Adolf would have been CGI.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the book would be at least CGI. Autograph book flying around.
I think that Adolf Hitler signing Indiana Jones's book is the monkey swinging from vines with Shayla Booth.
I mean, yeah, you're not far off. God. Well, it's at least the fridge, you know.
Yeah, okay. It's at least the fridge. Yeah.
Which I still feel is actually quite decent. I'm not going to lie.
It's a good gag until the fucking gophers.
Oh, the gophers, yeah. We should also see.
Yeah.
Can I get a gopher? Yeah. CGI. That's $10 million.
It was a fine gag. Indiana Jones is like, okay, what? Lead lines, perfect. That's a proper Indiana Jones gag, that is.
Yeah.
But to climb out of it and then be face to face with a gopher that pretty much does a double take. It's like, what?
Oh, man.
Indiana Jones is supposed to be goofy, it's supposed to be in touch with the supernatural. The Raiders of the Lost Ark, for instance, fucking ghosts flying around, killing people and pulling them back into a gold box. You've got the Holy Grail. You've got mystical, life-giving, glowing stones.
They get a UFO in the Crystal Skull.
And then the UFO, I get it. It's goofy and it's science fiction-y.
That was Lucas,
and stuff.
Man. That was Lucas all over that.
Put an alien in it, Steven. Put an alien in it, Steven.
Crossover event with fucking Star Wars, but Jar Jar in there.
My favourite anecdote that Steven Spielberg talks about when he talks about working with George Lucas, he says, our creative relationship is that George Lucas comes to me with ideas and then I say no to him.
You obviously didn't say no 10 years ago, did you?
That happened before Crystal Skull, because apparently he got worn down enough.
No shit.
Crystal Skull happened. I wish I'd watched it. I didn't have time today, but after finishing Crusade, I was like, I wish I had time, because I bet I've softened up on it a bit. I bet it's probably not as bad as
I'll probably enjoy it more than Temple of Doom, which I don't think really has any redeeming features other than I don't like that film. I don't like it. Like, I probably actually will look at Crystal Skull, but you know what? It's stupid, but Yeah, I guess more I guess she. There's probably something in it. It's actually probably kind of remotely satisfying to me. Whereas
when the millions of ants crawl into that guy's mouth and the camera goes into his mouth, right? Just remember, Adolf Hitler signed Indiana Jones's book in the previous film.
Or when he got pulled in quicksand using a snake. That was funny too.
Well, what do you think about Shia LaBeouf in this film?
Steve
like,
LaBeouf.
Is he the odd one out in this film, or does he make the film, or is he the what throws it out of balance in a way? Apart from like the UFO alien shit at the end,
2008 stunt casting.
Yeah,
just like it's 2023 stunt casting with Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
It was literally a year after Transformers, wasn't it? So it was just like
Shia LaBeouf has done Holes, and then he's done. Well, that was a sentence I never thought I'd ever say.
Whatever tastes good in Hollywood, man. Whatever tastes good.
Yeah. And then Shia LaBeouf was just bankable bums on seats. Oh, no.
Behave. This is a classy podcast. Come on.
But, I mean... I don't know.
Honestly, as much as people like to harp on Steve the Beef, I think the worst offender in that whole film is fucking Ray Winston.
Jonesy!
It's like every 5 minutes he's like turning heel, turning face, turning heel, turning face.
I'm a good guy. I'm a bad guy. I'm a good guy. I'm a
slag. It's just like, Jonesy! It's like,
don't worry. I was a centuple agent the whole time.
Oh,
yeah, Ray Winston has no business being in that film. And also, Karen Allen is not playing Marion Ravenwood.
No, seriously, she's just...
Yeah.
She's playing some caricature version that resembles her. That is it. That could have been... Right.
It's odd.
I get caught up in Indiana Jones fever. I have a one sheet of Crystal Skull. Because at that point, I hadn't seen the film.
This is going to be great. So, I can't wait.
It was on eBay. I won it for about 20 quid. I was like, that's fair enough for a cinema poster. And then I saw the film and I just don't know what that film is. Somewhere in that film is a decent film trying to fight its way out. And I've said it for years. I don't defend it, but I'm just saying somewhere in there... Amongst with Harrison Ford's performance and John Hurt and Jim Broadbent, somewhere in there is a film that's waiting to get out. Unfortunately, it's bogged down with so many. Oh my God, I just don't even know where to start.
Before the film came out, there was a trailer where Shia LaBeouf goes, "You're an archaeology professor?" And Indiana Jones has a low shot that pulls into him and he just goes, "Part time." And it's really cool. And then in the final release, for some reason, they went with a different take. So LaBeouf goes, "You're an archaeology professor?" And Indiana Jones goes, "Part-time." Why did they do that?
If Harrison Ford single-handedly carries that movie, there are moments where you can see that he's bored and just doing it because he seems contractually obliged to do so. But then there are great moments when his son gets stung by a scorpion and you had that wry smile that comes out of Harrison Ford and says, "How big was it?" "It was small." "Good." "Why is that good?" "No, he said big, wasn't it?" "It's like, 'cause the small ones are the ones that can kill you." And it's got that beautiful Harrison Ford energy to it.
I can hear his voice as well. I can hear him saying that.
Yeah, because it's the small ones that will get you. And it's just beautifully done. And then there are bits where, like, The motorbike chase through the university is all done physically as physical stunts. It's great. And then you get to the CG stuff and you're like, oh my God, like, why? Why does... And before I keep going, I'm going to hand it over to Rich because...
Oh, no, don't you start. I know you're going with this.
Because
bastard.
This film is what we all saw as a wedding party. Instead of a wedding reception, we all went to see Crystal Skull.
We went to a pub. We
no, I mean, like, you know, like after
we had a pub lunch
after the pub, and we all went to see it. Didn't we?
We did, yes, and it was fucking awful. Just like,
and we all came out of the cinema And I remember Rachel turned around to everyone. And there was about, must have been eight of us, I think, or something like that, easily.
Enough.
And she just went, "I'm so sorry." And I've always remembered it, because it was just like, she was apologising.
Yeah, I should apologise to her.
Because the film was awful.
Me and her husband should be apologising to her.
Whose wedding?
It was Rich and Rachel.
Yeah, dickhead. I'm a dickhead, so... Yep, 15 years later.
Wow.
You weren't to know, man. You were betrayed by the Hollywood machine.
It's my anniversary on Tuesday. Yeah. I just realised that. So it'll be 15 years watch ago the new one. On Tuesday. You should watch it on Tuesday.
Yeah, you should watch the new one and atone for your past sins, right? Yeah, it's going to be great.
I was going to watch Crystal Skull again. You remember this?
It's quite funny, actually, because when me and my wife got together in 2003... I said when 2008 came along, she's like, "Oh, new Indiana Jones movie was coming out," and she had the same reaction that we all did, because we all saw it at the same time after Richard's wedding. And we all came out of the cinema and we were just like, "What was that?" And I had to, I would defend myself, I had to go a second time to see if I wasn't making it up in my head. We went to see it a second time and I still... And the South Park guys put it beautifully when Steven Spielberg and George Lucas rape Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. It's a beautiful scene in South Park.
I mean, it's
where...
not.
No, it's not a beautiful scene. No.
But it is so painfully accurate. Crystal Skull. I just, somewhere in there, somewhere. Deep down. It's a... Oh, it's an okay short movie.
Good fan film, you know. It's...
Yeah. Okay, we've got through the films and...
I love how we just breezed past Crystal Skull in 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's all
I wish
deserves,
I'd watched it.
Really.
So
there's much more important stuff to talk about.
Because then I could sit here and defend it. I've got a feeling that it might be all right. I don't know, because I didn't watch it.
I'll say one favourable thing. I still thought, like, Cate Blanchett was great casting as, like, a rushy, you know, villainess. I thought, you know what, that's pretty cool. She's cool.
But yeah, it has its great moments. It has, and most of them are Harrison Ford and Cate Blanchett.
Fancy. Everything else. Yeah.
But
even John Hurt's just... shit. Yeah. What the hell was that use of John Hurt in that film? Seriously. Esteemed actor John Hurt. And he's just this like fucking like old homeless guy running around in the cave. Like.
Yeah, they didn't use Jim Broadbent was basically a placeholder for Denholm Elliott. And it's just like, great. I get it. I see where you're going with that. That's great casting. But John Hurt should have been there instead of Ray Winston for the whole film.
Yes, definitely.
And as the film goes on, he gets better when the skull was going, getting closer and closer to where it should be laid to rest and left there.
Mm-hmm.
And that should have been the film. But no, Ray Winston. So why? Why?
I think the I'll give it credit for the very end where they tease you thinking that Shia LaBeouf is going to be the new Indiana Jones.
Oh, no.
And then, and then Harrison Ford takes the hat away from him and says, "No, fuck you. I'm still Indiana Jones." I liked that. Did no one else like that?
I liked it, yeah. Go make Transformers 2. Yeah. Fuck off. Right.
Yeah, because it was like, because that would have been awful if they were going to pass the torch to him. But I like that they made a point of not doing that.
I could see the idea behind it, but also
Shia LaBeouf.
There's only one guy that can play Indiana Jones, and it's Harrison Ford.
Yeah. And that's what the film was saying.
I was going to say Chris Pratt. And so.
Respect that.
Oh, no. Those photoshops. Oh, God. That was
it belongs in a museum. That's my Chris Pratt impression.
White guy. American accent. I mean, if you were like forced by gunpoint to be like, okay, we are going to do an Indiana Jones reboot, you're going to have to like it. Who would you cast? Mm-hmm.
Nathan Fillion.
I knew you were going to say that.
I can see that.
Is he a bit old now?
He might be a bit old now, yeah.
He's in his 50s now, yeah. Nathan. Mm. I don't know. I think Indiana Jones, you can do a prequel quite easily because they've already done that with the young Indiana Jones, which I used to watch as a kid, actually. It wasn't perfect. It was just your classic mid-teenagers drama on a Sunday morning. But I really enjoyed it because I was in the Indiana Jones nut job basically in the 90s, so I used to watch it on Sunday mornings. It might have been like 8 a.m.
What was it on? Was it on BBC or like Channel 4 or something? I forget now. I think it was BBC, wasn't it?
It was on one of them. At like 7, it was on 7 or 8 in the morning, you know, the time slot just before the kids get up. I don't know what their target audience was for it in this country. They're just kind of like 7 a.m. in the morning. Why? Why isn't 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday would be perfect for the young Indiana Jones?
Was that one of the first uses of CGI? I thought that was a precursor to Terminator 2, wasn't it? With like the whole... There was like a scene with like a stained glass window or something. That's right. Like CG.
That was the young Sherlock Holmes. That was
it? Oh, shit, was it Sherlock Holmes? Yeah. That was Indiana Jones?
Yeah.
No. Same thing. He was shit.
I remember there was a lot of like crowd production that they did with like CGI as well. I remember young Indiana Jones did have some...
I think so. It
like,
was
pioneering that... TV effect stuff.
Yeah, it was that early mid-90s boom of things becoming easier on smaller budgets.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. The guy who played his father was doing a great Sean Connery impression. Like, they even had him have a beard and everything, and it was really well done. And once it's uploaded, I might sit down and watch it and go, this is awful. But again, for George Lucas to go, we've already done a prequel, like a 12-minute vignette prequel, so why don't we just turn it into a TV show? And it worked and got a good few seasons out of it, and I really enjoyed it.
There's one other major ingredient of the Indiana Jones films that we haven't really talked about that much, which I feel that we should have a quick discussion on before we move on, and that's obviously the soundtrack to Indiana Jones and the music that John Williams composed for the film. And barring Jurassic Park, you know, the Indiana Jones theme is probably my favourite of the John Williams catalogue of film soundtracks that he's done, and it just really, I don't know, it just really grabbed hold of the Indiana Jones theme, didn't it? And just, I don't know, like the whole theme tune to Indiana Jones just amplifies everything that you see on the screen when it plays, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect. Music composers are fucking wizards. Because I don't know how you encapsulate a vibe in a soundtrack, but John Williams does it over and over and over again, and the Indiana Jones one is it's crucial to the package. And when you were a kid and you were swinging on tree vines, you were going because that was the Indiana Jones music, and that's a crucial part of it. And yeah, I agree. I think it's probably slightly behind Star Wars in terms of my favorite, but it is incredible. And I was watching Last Crusade today, and I think that Last Crusade has like my favorite, some of my favorite arrangements.
I mean, for me, it doesn't get any better than the actual Ark of the Covenant theme. That gives me goosebumps every time I hear it, especially in the scene itself. But just listening to it isolated, it's like, as much as I love the indie theme, the Ark of the Covenant theme is just where it peaks for me, and probably of all John Williams' music, it's fucking beautiful. So nice.
I've been trying to track down for nearly 10 years the expanded edition for the soundtracks, which gives you unused music or alternate takes, but you can't get it for like less than $150. It's insane. Because they're limited editions, like 4 CD sets of expanded soundtrack. But the way John Williams puts the comedic elements in, like the basket chase, for instance, and it's not too comical. And then you get this, like Rich said, that very atmospheric music that's very mysterious and kind of creepy, and it puts you at unease. And that's on purpose, because he's telling a story just with the music. I've not done a music score without the dialogue before, so it might be an interesting take actually to do that. But the music for all three of the films is fantastic, and even the concertos, those small little movements that he puts in there, I've always loved that blast of the theme that comes out in Crusade when they're both on the bike and they come out of the wooden crate after distracting the Nazi goons, and you just hear that ba-da-da-da-da, and then it just cuts into this beautiful music as they're being chased down this hillside on this bike. And it's just gorgeous. Gorgeous music. I mean, like I said, I love Jurassic Park. I love lots of John Williams, but Indiana Jones and a close second, if you... Hook has its problems, but if you listen to the... Just listen to the score. Just close your eyes and listen to the score. That composer tells you a story without a script and without visuals. The score to Hook is one of my all-time favourites. It is John Williams at his best, and it's glorious. And Indiana Jones music to me is, like I said, not so much the theme, but what he does in and around the theme.
Yeah, all the incidental stuff. It's just...
And some of it's so subtle that you don't even notice until you listen to the soundtrack and you're like, whoa, wait, what?
Mm.
And then you watch the film again and your brain trained itself to find it. And then you find it like, I had no idea that was scored. Like the tiny bits of music they're playing when they're trying to work out the location of the Ark and where it's resting in that, you know, when they're in the hut where the monkey dies.
mm-hmm.
It's just such a subtle piece of music that I didn't know was even there until I listened to an expanded soundtrack on YouTube, and I was like, whoa, wait, what? And then sure enough, headphones on, crank the volume up, there it is, just nestling in that small little moment. And even Crystal Skull, if you listen to the soundtrack to Crystal Skull, the themes done for the skull and the Mayan temple is haunting and foreboding as fuck, and it is glorious. The film might not be great, but the score is fantastic.
I'm hearing tremendous things about his score for Dial of Destiny. You know, people are saying he knocks it out of the park. Like, obviously, it's his swan song. But
well, not now, because he's not retiring now.
Yeah. What the fuck, man? Come on.
he said he was going to retire. And
how old is he now?
91,
dude,
I think.
Holy shit.
And he was going to do his retirement piece. He was going to do one final Indiana Jones score, and then he announced... must have been a month ago that he wasn't retiring. Well, he'd be semi-retired, but still do small gigs.
It's just like his last film is like a DreamWorks animation or something.
Probably. But what makes me sad is, like, if when Spielberg was supposed to direct, I think John Williams wouldn't have scored it if that wasn't a last-minute change. Mm. I got the feeling that he was already composing it when Spielberg departed the project. But it wouldn't be an Indiana Jones movie without John Williams. But then we said that about Star Wars, and then you watch Rogue One, and you're like...
That was, oh, what's his face? Composer? Oh, it was Giacchino, wasn't it?
Michael Giacchino, yeah. Fabulous composer, yeah. And...
Your father would be proud. He's just like, fuck.
Yeah, and I just... I said it before and I'll say it again. Indiana Jones without Steven Spielberg could be a good thing and equally a bad thing, because we haven't experienced an Indiana Jones movie without Spielberg before.
Hold those thoughts. We'll get into Dial of Destiny in just a second. But before we do that, I did ask in our Discord if anyone in there, listeners, wanted to share any, you know, thoughts or memories on Indiana Jones. And we did have one person come back who wanted to share what they thought of Indiana Jones and what it meant to them. So a big thank you to Grammar Purist for sending in this voice message. Now, he wasn't aware, and I wasn't aware, that for the podcasters, for Spotify, whatever you want to call it these days, the voicemail is limited to 1 minute. That's it. That's all you get, is 1 minute. So unfortunately, he did cut out near the end, but he did send me it in written form so I can finish it off once the audio is finished playing. So I'm going to play that now. So here's the Grammar Purist and his thoughts on Indiana Jones.
Grammar Purist here. I am calling in to talk about Indiana Jones and my affinity for the series. I am a huge fan of the first three movies. Love them dearly. Think they are probably three of the greatest package movies ever made, even though technically they're really not a trilogy. They're still among the most entertaining and fun movies to watch. I'll never forget sitting in the movie theater and watching the special effect of the heart being extracted from the chest in that fantastic scene that has been made less iconic than the melting face of the first movie, but I think is better effectually in terms of terror than the first one. Not a fan of what came after. Number four, did not like. Holding out great hope for Dial of Destiny, however. We'll see how that one does when it's released later.
That's where his audio finished, but he did continue by just saying that the previews had been promising and the reviews this weekend out of Cannes are mostly positive. So I know I'll catch it in the theatre. I hope it's an appropriate swan song for the character and the franchise.
I know IGN shat on it, but apparently Total Film gave it a decent review. So yeah, I don't trust IGN anyway. So they gave Rise of Skywalker 7 out of 10, which was way too high.
Generous.
Way too high.
How much money were you getting, IGN?
Yeah. But yeah, no, a massive thank you to Grammar Purist for sending that in. It's really appreciated, and it's something that we'd like to incorporate into the show more, you know, to send your views and your thoughts on the stuff that we're covering. So, and he pretty much just basically, I think, said everything that we've already said about the Indiana Jones and what it means to us and what it means to him. So, yeah, big thank you to him. And
thanks, Grammar Purist.
Thank you, Grammar Purist.
That was great. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Appropriate time just to move into our last section of the podcast then, and our hopes and fears for Dial of Destiny. Obviously coming off the back of the Crystal Skull, which obviously has a lot of mixed feelings for more bad than good, you know, from what we've said about it. And you know, the trailer, it looks good from the trailers, seems to be a bit of positiveness around the film, but obviously there's still that chance that it can still disappoint us. I mean, we can talk about, like I said, hopes and fears quickly on the film. Guys, well, what are your hopes and fears for Dial of Destiny?
There's too much alliteration with that title. I don't like it. But it seems to be incredibly mixed, which is kind of what I hate, but also what I kind of attach my hope to, that it's not going to be really, really bad. I mean, I'm looking at Rotten Tomatoes at the moment. It's very, very in the middle. It's like 54% at the moment. But it's only obviously so many reviews. It's not a lot at the moment. So most of those are from Cannes, and I'm assuming some outlets got early access to it. But I don't know. Hopes-wise, yeah, I just kind of want it to be a nice, enjoyable final romp for indie. I mean, James Mangold is a really competent director, so I'd be quite gutted if he does fuck this up, because like the last film I watched of his was Logan, and it's fantastic, and it seems appropriate as well, as kind of, you know, a farewell to a character that's now, you know, older and hasn't quite got it anymore, a bit like Logan. Yeah, I don't know, I just don't want an abundance of CGI.
we know it's happening.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's a bit more measured.
I'm sure I heard or read somewhere that they tried to go as practical as they could.
They said that with Crystal Skull, and then most of it got replaced with CG.
I remember that with bloody like Jurassic World bloody as well.
Oh, God.
Yeah. They made a prequel to The Thing as well, and they said, it's all practical, and they scrapped it all and replaced it with...
But you watch those videos on YouTube of the concepts they were working on. They looked fucking great.
But, like, I mean, CGI in 2022-23 is a different game than it was right in 2008. 2008, it was like, look at what we can fucking do with computers, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, I remember, like,
these days, it's possible to do it deftly in a way that doesn't stand out.
I always remember that stampede scene in Peter Jackson's King Kong, when they're like, it was like they were running on a treadmill in the green screen. Yeah. And like, the arm was pumping, and it's like Brachiosaurus behind him was like, this is like,
it wasn't even like composited properly. Wasn't even composited properly. You know, oh God.
It was so bad.
Like, look at the compositing of the monkey swinging scene in Crystal Skull.
I'm gonna watch it tomorrow, and I'm gonna enjoy it, I think. It's going to be good.
Some people have actually fixed it on their home laptops. People have fixed it.
Did they just highlight that scene and then hit press delete?
Probably. I've said this before. If instead of the swinging
Control
monkeys,
F,
the perfect
monkeys, delete.
They should have cut that scene when he goes up the tree, lands on the branch, and then looks at a monkey. Cut.
Yeah.
You don't need to see the rest. No. Just cut it.
Replace all the monkeys with NFTs.
Yeah.
The rest of the film.
The gag just works. Just, you know, or place the monkeys with Ewoks. I don't know. Has someone done that yet?
Gungans, have a that.
I'm looking forward to seeing. I was blown away by young Harrison Ford in those trailers.
Oh,
some of the reviews, amazing.
And Mads Mikkelsen as well, man. Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
Some of the reviews I've read have said that it doesn't quite work and that he's a little bit dead-eyed. But I don't know. I'm excited to see that in the cinema. I'm excited for the John Williams score and to just see Harrison Ford on a big screen again. Because how many more times is that going to happen? I don't know.
Exactly.
Well, it will never happen again in terms of it being Indiana Jones. But yeah, I'm excited to do that. I am a bit worried though, because I think the worst outcome for this, like Crystal Skull, we talk about Crystal Skull, which is a good thing. We're talking about it because we don't like it, but it's in our minds and we remember it, and it's notable, and there are bits that stand out in that film as being good, even though the film's bad. The worst outcome for me would be for the Dial of Destiny to just be kind of meh and middling, and I'm worried because it seems like maybe that's the case, but I'm just going to reserve judgment. I'm going to go in with no expectations, or try to anyway, and just see if I can have a good time with it.
Is that the first Disney-funded production of Indiana Jones as well, isn't it? So that would probably have some effect, I guess, in the film, wouldn't it?
It's hard to say.
Will it do a Star Wars kind of, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, in the Star Wars that are made now through Disney than the Star Wars of old? And will we see some kind of effect or influence of Disney in this film? And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Things I think the same could be said for any studio now. The problem is they're all trying to cater towards that whole like fan community. They're putting like lots of little like they lean heavy on the member berries and making it very cute corporate package. Like if it was Sony, for instance, they'd be doing a film about some insignificant character. They'd do a spin-off film about, you know, Salah or something. They're like, why?
Your concerns are exactly what mine is. I don't want them to kill Indiana Jones.
They better not.
No, I don't think they'll do that.
But I'm also worried about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's, enhancements. Because she was brought on for No Time to Die.
I think.
To try and shave off that chauvinistic.
I forget she was involved in that as well. Shit.
And she was brought in deliberately to say, what are we doing wrong? What are we not representing? Oh, you've done a really successful stage show and TV show, which is fantastic, by the way. If ever you guys watch Fleabag, it is brilliantly done. But to have her in it as his goddaughter and also being a script doctor at the same time, it's just not worrying from any malicious point, but it's very difficult to work out what they mean by that until we see the film.
Are you saying that you're worried Indiana Jones is going to go woke?
No, not at all.
Sounds like that's what you're saying, Chris. What's your problem with that?
At all.
I'm joking. Not at all. I'm joking.
It's more like I watched No Time to Die and everyone was saying, oh, we can tell what Phoebe Waller-Bridge added or took away. And I'm like, I don't know what she added to that film
neither.
At all.
No.
I'm not familiar enough with her as a person or as a writer to know what I'm looking for. So will it help Indiana Jones? I don't know. But they seem to be hammering home the point so much on socials that it's becoming exceeding worrying that they keep mentioning it in the first couple of sentences. It's
That night.
You know what I mean? It's
that night from The Last Crusade. His pronouns are they, them. So.
Yeah, it's just. I don't know.
I haven't seen any of that, but I've been like staying away from most information about this. I generally like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and I guess I'm not too concerned about it. But I do understand what you're saying. I think the biggest impact is going to be that it's not directed by Spielberg, right? So any sort of impact that Phoebe Waller-Bridge might have, positive or negative, it's probably negligible next to the fact that Spielberg isn't involved.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of word about how, like, Mangold, he obviously is very good at, like, framing nice tight shots, but he doesn't have that, like, almost musical way of telling a cinematic story like Spielberg does. It's very, yeah, I don't know. Which is, it's not a knock on him, it's just, that's the wonder of Spielberg in his prime. I mean,
what if, at the end, Indiana Jones gets an opportunity to save somebody else by sacrificing himself, and there's a piano arrangement of the Indiana Jones theme, and he just says, "Fortune and glory, kid," before, like, walking into the fire, and he dies. Would you be all right with that? Does that sound good?
As long as you don't see him die.
There's a really slow piano version of the theme.
Like, a really slow piano version of it.
As long, as you don't see him close his eyes and die on the floor.
And then Phoebe Waller-Bridge puts the hat on and the theme starts up. Sounds rad. Let's do that.
To have the reaction that Kathleen Kennedy had when they took the de-aging footage and they thought they'd found an unused shot from Raiders, I want to experience that without knowing too much.
Mm.
So I've only seen the first few teaser shots and the trailer that was out, was it about a month ago now? I want to go in spoiler free.
Mm, absolutely.
So I would rather not know too much about the film. Mm. So
yeah, but it's totally understandable. I can't agree more with that. That's exactly.
I just don't want that morbid ending. But I don't think they'll do that. I think they'll respect it enough to go, no, this is what we're doing. This is what we're about.
It's got to end on a high, surely.
You'd hope. Is Karen Allen in this one, or is she not?
No one said anything. And I haven't been to look at spoilers or reviews because I don't want that surprise, if there is a surprise, to be.
Will they deal?
I mean, if they kill her off screen, I won't be happy either. Just mention it. Oh, when I lost my wife. So, oh, fuck off, movie. No.
Like, one last thing, I guess, like, we mentioned about Jason Mangold with the direction. Do you think, like, he might try and bring in something new, you know, fresh ideas, more modern takes on what he might be able to do with Indiana Jones? Or do you think maybe he might have tried that and, like, Disney has shot him down and said, no, you just need to cut the shots that people are going to expect from Indiana.
Generate
Indiana
the content.
Film.
Will there be a one shot in it? Will there be, like, you know, an extended one shot sequence?
My God, what would you do if there was, like, a slow mo Matrix style kind of shot in this film?
No.
Like, like with Star Wars, they played it way too safe. Let's just do what they expect. Let's just do this and not offend people, and they learned a lesson from Rian Johnson and played it even safer for the third one. But that's what I don't want it to be. I also don't want it to be so safe that it becomes just another safe Marvel movie that are just repackaged. It's just, I don't know. I don't want it to be too. There's so many complex things about these films that it's difficult to try and nail it down.
Is there going to be a scene at the end of this where it's like, oh, somehow, you know, Belloc survived? It's just, he comes back.
It's just an opening scroll that says somehow Belloc speaks. The dead speak.
Well, if rumors are true, what I read before, where as it was being filmed, this was months and months ago, it is entirely possible with the subject matter of the film, that's what they went with in the end.
Of course.
But also, we were watching Raiders the other night, and I turned around to my wife and I said, every time you watch this, can you take that actor seriously? And she went, what? And I said, do you recognise the actor? She went, no. So if I turn around and said, stop this madness. And she went, is that the priest from Hot Fuzz?
Also Ivan Ooze as well.
And Ivan Ooze, yeah. And she was like, I was like, no. And I said, yeah. And all I could hear in my head every time he spoke was, Jesus Christ.
It was a peas and rice from the TV version.
Peas and peas rice and from rice. The PG.
It was like, bang. Yeah. It was like...
peas and rice. I haven't watched that PG rated version for ages.
No, Ivan Ooze is still great.
Leslie Tiller was funking mad. Oh, I just love it. Is he still alive?
Yeah, Paul Freeman's alive, yeah.
How cool would that be if they kind of, like, well, actually, no, it wouldn't be cool. It'd be cringy as fuck if they went back through the history and Back to Future Part 2. I just, no.
We want it to be unpredictable and not too predictable. That's the same thing, really, isn't it? But yeah, we just don't want it to be too unpredictable, do we?
But to be also have the nods. Semi-dictable.
Yeah, semi-dictable. I like that, Steve. Yeah. Yeah, we'll go with semi-dictable. That's what we want Dial of Destiny to be. Semi-dictable. That's the Wolfie thing. Stamp of approval thing. Right there. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for this week. A massive thank you, as always, for everyone joining us. If you would like to donate to the show, then please visit our Ko-fi page, where you can show your support starting from just a single pound. Please come and join us in our Discord server to discuss the topics we cover, films, TV, video games, and much more. And also have the opportunity to be a part of the show and send in your thoughts and memories of the things that we cover on the show. The link can be found in the show description or on our website. Speaking of the website, please give it a visit. We have articles, game reviews, our entire back catalogue of episodes and more at thewolfiepod.com. Don't forget, if you're listening on YouTube, then do the stuff. Ring the bell, click the subscribe button, all that kind of jazz. That'd be great. Thank you very much. Chaps, it's time to say goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
You are named after the dog.
Yeah, I laughed at that.
That was good. I love that. My name has been Jason, and you've been listening to What's Wrong with Wolfie, a retro podcast to the max. We'll catch you on the next one. Goodbye.
Barking.